Welcome to Creative Mind Soul Sessions with Deborah Burnt Maldonado and Dr. Rob Maldonado, founders of Creative Mind. Explore personal growth with us through Jungian psychology, Eastern spirituality, and social neuroscience in a deep but practical way. Let's begin. Hello, welcome to Soul Sessions with Creative Mind. I'm Deborah Burnt Maldonado. I'm here with Dr. Rob Maldonado.
Good to be here.
We are going to talk about emotions today. And before we begin, I do want to remind you, if you're watching us on YouTube, click the button here in the corner and subscribe to our channel. And if you are listening to us on Spotify, iTunes, or any of those podcasts, wonderful services that deliver this over the airwaves, please subscribe so you can make sure you get every episode of Soul Session. And that helps us a lot to get more listeners and get this information out to more people. So we're talking about emotions today. And, you know, I always felt that there's good emotions and there's bad emotions. And we want, if we're sad, we want to be happy. So we're going to bust through some myths here around emotions and talk about, like, you know, a little bit about how they were created and how we can work with them.
Yeah. So in general, emotions, they can lock us into these patterns, but because they are the key that locks the door, it's also the key that turns the lock the other way and unlocks the door and frees us. But it's all how we work with these emotions and how we look at them.
Well, I think maybe a lot of people don't realize that the conditioning, when people talk about their patterns, that it's emotional. They think of thought patterns, like I'm thinking negatively or I have a negative
thought. Or behavioral patterns.
Or behavioral patterns. But they're all tied to emotion.
Yeah. So in psychology, there's a lot of different models of emotions. And unfortunately, once it gets out into the public, they're often misinterpreted and kind of simplified to think in terms of good and bad, that there's these good emotions and bad emotions and toxic emotions that you need to run away from.
Negative and higher vibrations and lower vibrations.
Yeah, and a lot of that is not really good psychology. It's not a good way of understanding our mind. Our mind is a finely tuned instrument, very complex, but very, very good at fitting into its environment. And emotions are really the key to help us fit into these environments smoothly.
And as babies, so we were talking about early development, we feel our environment more than we think about our environment. That's right. Why the emotions have that conditioning effect?
Part of it, yes. Early on, the brain systems for emotions are ready to go day one, whereas the cognitive ones are not there yet.
They don't go online yet.
Yeah, they don't come online until later because those cognitive structures need language, and language takes a few years for us to acquire. But the emotional impact, and there's some YouTube videos that maybe we'll post the links on, where the mother is singing these beautiful arias and the baby feels it. In other words,
they hear the tone of the words. Even they don't understand the words, but the tone of it,
the music, the music is communicating emotion, and they're picking up exactly what these emotions mean already on day one. So anyway, the whole idea is in those early experiences that we have from one to about seven, you know, there's some leeway there, but around that age, right before we really get into school and all this stuff, those early experiences leave a strong emotional impression on us that tells us who we are as people, as individuals, and what we can expect from the world. So that's essentially most of our life, who we are, right? Our identity and what we can expect from the world. In other words, as I go out into the world, how is it going to treat me? Is it going to be a friendly place, a hostile place? Do I need to be smart? Do I need to be clever? Do I need to lie?
Do I need to cry and show my emotions? Do I need to hold it back?
Exactly.
Be afraid to show how I feel?
all those patterns are already in place by the time we go.
And then don't we genetically have similar emotional patterns from, you know, the conditioning from our parents' genetics? And, you know, there's like a style of being and a level of how we feel and all those things. And we learn from them too. We look at how they handle emotions. If they are outburst all the time, you know, we may learn that's the way to communicate. Where if they're like kind of like even keeled all the time, we kind of learn without words that, oh, that's the way you should be.
Yeah, you're describing temperament. Mm-hmm. So temperament is genetically predetermined, but then it's shaped the way we express our temperament. It's shaped by those early experiences so that it's a combination.
Oh, okay.
But let's
see. And every kid has a different temperament. Like parents will say, my first child was so easy, but the second child was a nightmare. They were always like fussy and all that. And if I had that one first, I don't know if I would have had a second one, or, you know, vice versa. You know, the second one was so much easier. So it's a combination. Like maybe that their genetics gave them a certain temperament. But also when you're the mother and it's the first child, you're maybe be a little more nervous, maybe not sure of how, you know, anxious around the new baby, where the second one you kind of did it before and you're more comfortable. And so all of that, those little tiny little differences can change a person. And a lot of people, you know, wonder like why their siblings are so different and they have different ways of reacting. It's because of that. These tiny little micro experiences that we have.
Exactly. So it's that combination. That's why people born into the same family might react very differently to situations emotionally, because they're bringing their own temperament, combination of genes and epigenetics into the mix. But let's look at the family. So because that's our first environment for most of us, right? The family structure is like the environment that emotionally we have to navigate. Who are we attached to? Who does the discipline?
Yeah.
Who rewards us with love and affection and attention, and who punishes us if we do something wrong or out of step? All those things leave subtle, powerful impressions on us unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the key. This is not, we're not talking emotional intelligence, because emotional intelligence is usually thought of at the cognitive, conscious level. These emotional patterns are laid down unconsciously. In other words,
you might not know they're there. Yeah, like exactly. Like that one time I told you I had was triggered, and you were like, that's your anger. And I'm like, I don't have any anger. And then when I really kind of did some of the work that we do in Jungian coaching, we understand, oh, wait, there's stuff here that I haven't looked at yet. And that's really the difference with a lot of coaching and Jungian coaching, the depth coaching. We're really going a little deeper into what the core is driving us versus just what we can see on a surface.
Secondly, then peers, once we grow up a little bit and they send us up to school with a lunchbox. Did you ride the bus when you were a kid?
No, I walked to school. It was only 2 blocks away.
Yeah, I used to ride my bike too. The peers, right, the people that influence us the most at that age, or starting after 6, 7, are our peers, the ones that we connect with as friends and the little groups, the cliques that we hang out with, right? They have a big influence on our sense of self and what we can expect from the world, who we're going to be out there in the world.
You know, I think that is so, I was shocked when you told me that, because everyone focuses on, and I used to do this too, focus on the childhood, but never understood that the peers, that the people you surround yourself with, they're the people you live your life by. So your parents, you know, in a way, like you're not going to hang out with them the rest of your life. You're really going to socialize with your peers. So from a social perspective, that is really important. So if you're accepted into a group, if you're not, how your friends treat you, all those things are emotionally conditioning us to how to behave. Are we the loud one in the group? Are we quiet? Do we, you know, speak up? Are we the easygoing person? You always see these teen dramas where the teen is like awkward and then their friends bring her out of her shell and create something new. So we're so want to be accepted by our peers, initially our parents for survival, but the peers, aren't they really more about our social survival?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. If you look at a group of kids in the playground, you'll see everything you see in politics, everything you see in societies, everything you see in the office.
Like the Lord of the Flies, that movie where the kids all took roles, or the archetypal roles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's alliances formed. Who is the leader? Who is the alpha? All these things. And then who are your peers, right? Who do you see yourself equal to? Mm. And who do you see above you and below you? All those things are done unconsciously again.
Are you the cheerleader? Are you the football player? Are you the popular one? You know, that kind of thing. Or the nerd?
Yeah. All those stay with us at some level, although, like you say, we might not be aware of them. We forget them. We think, well, I'm not in that environment anymore. I grew out of it. But our mind records a lot of those patterns because they're important to us. It's teaching us about who we are and how the world works.
So when you go to work, you're kind of in the playground again. I noticed that. Like when I used to work for a big entertainment company, and they had this huge, it was called The Lodge, and everyone, there was TV producers, and there were writers, and there were the graphic people, and then the accounting people, and then the marketing people, and then the finance people, and everyone kind of sat in their little groups, and they all dressed differently, and I said, and it was like those same kind of tables you had like in a cafeteria. And I said, oh my God, this feels like junior high, because the cool people were the producers and the creatives. And then the accountants were all like, you know, the finance people were all like kind of buttoned up and very conservative the way they dressed. So I was like, oh my God. And so we go into our workplace and we're unconsciously bringing, maybe if you were the nerd and you kind of bring that, like, do people accept me? And you're looking for that acceptance still in the group. Are you the socially in the office? And then also the hierarchy too. Like, yeah. What I noticed is that when the nerdy guys became the boss, they kind of had this kind of arrogance a little bit, like kind of like almost compensation for being teased all the time. So they were like, oh, I'm so great. And, you know, these tech companies, you kind of see them that they were probably teased a lot. And so they're compensating. So a lot of that comes from those times instead of just your parents. And then your parents, of course, on top of that. But yeah, there's so many things that happen to our life that we're unconsciously carrying with us that really help us shape our experiences.
And of course, the teachers have a big influence in the school that you go to, the neighborhood that you grow up in, the churches, the institutions surrounding your environment, which is what we call culture. Mm. It includes language, religious norms, behavioral patterns in the community. All those things, our mind is finely tuned to absorb all those, that information, and to make of it what we need to make of it. In other words, what does it mean for me? How is this going to help me survive or not survive? Our mind is doing all that work intuitively.
And unconsciously, right?
Unconsciously.
Yeah. Now, is it an emotionally?
Emotionally.
Like what feels safe, what doesn't, that type of thing?
Exactly. Neuroscience is just getting to the point where we can start to see how the brain reacts to certain stimuli, where the individual is not even conscious of it, but because the images are pointing to some of these elements, we can record the person's reactions unconsciously. Mm-hmm. So if you ask the individual, did you feel any response? They're not at all. No conscious awareness of what that reaction was. Mm-hmm. So we react differently to familiar faces, people that look like us, people that are different from us, different parts of the neighborhood, different images that show poverty, wealth, all those things we've already kind of, our brain has already learned how to respond unconsciously to those
and
things.
Projecting, like you start a new job and everyone's what you look like, they're projecting all these assumptions on you, mm-hmm. you know, and then you can't be anything else. And you're doing that to everyone else as well. How do we become conscious of these things? First of all, what if we never become conscious of it? What if we just kind of like, that's the way that person is. This is the way I am. And you're kind of, just trying to get through the day and yeah. maybe doing some stress relief and Brock's breathing and trying to get through anxiety or even medicating because it's so stressful. That probably could be, you know, if you don't look at it, that's what happens. Like you cope with it on a conscious level only.
Yeah. So that early adulthood period, right? Once we get out of school and we start to look for a job or go to college and kind of become an adult, or the early adulthood period, then you see that these patterns that were laid down very early on, they start to play out in the way we do relationships. Not only that, but also the kind of work that we do. And this is difficult for a lot of people to accept, that we are conditioned by those early experiences in the way we're going to choose our partners and the kind of relationships we're going to have, whether they're going to be long-term marriages or divorce or in fights or dysfunctions and all that. As well as what kind of work are we going to do as far as our careers, and are we going to be happy in these situations?
Are you looking for a satisfying career as a life coach? If you are seeking a deeper path of training and growth, Creative Mind University offers an ICF-accredited life coach training program that goes beyond surface positive thinking and into a powerful process of real transformation. You can start your new career as a certified life coach trained in a unique methodology based on Jungian theory, Eastern spirituality, and social neuroscience. Get the tools to become your true self, change your life, and the lives of others. Visit creativemindlife.com, click on apply, and speak with one of our team members today to discuss your future and possibilities of becoming a certified life coach. That's creativemindlife.com. Well, you know what I love? Jung talked about the unconscious and the projections and all that. And what you showed me is that this map that our unconscious is speaking to other people all the time. And they're kind of affecting us unconsciously. And that's why we keep getting the same boss that doesn't appreciate us, the same job that doesn't give us more money, the team members that maybe don't work hard enough, or good team members, right? You're kind of resonating with them. And then all that dynamics with a partner, like unconsciously, a lot of people, I know for me, it's like you look online and you look at the profile and what they say on their persona, but unconsciously we're drawn to people and we can't figure out why. Like, why do I like this person who does not fit into my life at all? Why am I drawn to them versus this other person who makes a lot of sense? Why don't I, you know, fall in love with the good guy or the good girl? And why am I always bringing in these troublesome relationships or friendships even that are constantly, you know, struggling? And, you know, and it's all because if you're not examining the unconscious, you're emotionally kind of connected to them in some way. And it's usually not a choice, right?
Yeah, we think of these as assumptions that we're making about what relationships are, how they should play out. All these are unconscious, meaning that if someone doesn't match those assumptions, we're repelled by them. We don't feel the attraction for them. But if those assumptions are met by the way this person is, we feel attracted to them. We feel that chemistry, and we think because it's chemistry, it must be real love or it must be real healthy attraction. But it's not about healthy or unhealthy. It's simply that it's matching a lot of the early emotional patterns that are in the unconscious mind, and therefore they're triggering this sense of connectedness and familiarity.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like my father was kind of like stoic, pulled back, not showing a lot of emotion. And I saw that as like, and he was the power in the family. And that's another thing that we're emotionally drawn to the characteristics that exert power. So we want to borrow that power. And so when I was dating, if a guy showed his emotion and was like, oh, Debbie, you know, and I saw that as weakness. And I aligned power with that kind of distance. And so I always was attracted to people before you, Rob, that were kind of distant and not emotionally available. And I couldn't figure out why I kept doing that. And it's this unconscious alignment that it makes sense to your unconscious that you would be drawn to someone who had the power. It doesn't matter what their personality is like, but more you're drawn emotionally to the power, not the logical, I want someone to love me back and I want someone who wants a commitment. That's a cognitive idea. And we don't have power over our thoughts, only have so much power. Like this whole thing, your thoughts create your life. It really is your emotions create your life.
Yeah. And in our programs, of course, we teach this a little bit more in detail.
Yeah.
But here is where attachment style comes in, mm-hmm. especially in relationships. The attachment styles just kind of give you it answers two questions for you. One, am I willing to trust others with my heart, with my emotions,
mm-hmm.
right? And if that question is no, then you're always guarded. You're right. You might find great people, but you're not going to trust them regardless.
Why are you looking at me?
Because that's what happens
I know.
To all of us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The other question is, can I trust others?
Mm.
Right? Can I trust others? In other words, one of them is about you.
Do I trust myself?
Yeah.
And the other one's, do I trust others?
Yes. Or am I ready to trust others? And the other one is, are others trustworthy?
Mm-hmm.
So you might be ready to experience love, but if the question is I cannot trust others, then again you'll be guarded.
You know, and it's so funny because I don't think anyone on the planet is 100% trustful. I mean, we've all been let down. We've all been disappointed. I mean, when our parents say, you know, sometimes parents give mixed signals. And you learn, like, I can't trust what they're going to say. Like, we're, you know, that there's a Santa Claus, and then all of a sudden there's not a Santa Claus. They've been lying to me the whole time. I mean, little things like that. Oh, sorry, those who still believe. and I think the what we want to look at is the spectrum of trust versus I trust or I don't trust, but more like the spectrum. And so to change your relationships in everything, do I trust my boss? Do I trust my employees? Do I trust my partner? Do I trust the person who does my hair? You know, like all these things. Do I trust the world in a way? And I think it's not just turning it on and off, but actually, how do I expand my level of trust? Mm-hmm. And how do I look at trust where I'm in my power, where I don't feel vulnerable, like this, I'm going to just fall and hopefully someone will catch me. You know, that faith fall that they do at this ropes course trainings. It's really this idea of trust we all deal with.
Yeah. And the first question is more like, am I worthy of love, right? Mm. Do I feel worthy of love or others loving me?
And acknowledgement. That's another form of love. You know, just being acknowledged by your boss and getting a promotion. And if they don't, it's really that he doesn't love me or she doesn't love me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All those are very subtle emotions, of course. And we feel it at different degrees with different individuals, depending on our level of trust and how what the circumstances are. But those early adulthood experiences also leave a strong imprint on our learning emotionally.
Mm.
And we seem to be shut off at this point from the unconscious. And I think it's an evolutionary thing that at that early stage of our adulthood, we should be focused on the external, on developing our persona, like Jung says, on doing something in the world and developing our social skills. It's not until we enter that midlife, although midlife is a weird term now. It's more like
we don't know how long we're going to live now. 50 could be midlife now.
Well, also, yeah. we live so much longer than in Jung's time.
Yeah.
So midlife really for us might be 50. But around 30, 35, we start to question those early experiences. Mm-hmm. Right? And we start to kind of feel like...
You're outgrowing them in a way. You're just yeah. like, oh, this doesn't fit anymore.
And
psychologically, I can't wear my stonewashed jeans anymore.
Yeah, and psychologically, what's happening is the unconscious is opening up to us now. In other words,
it's like a pressure, kind of a force coming from within us. That feeling of unease, and people think it's wrong, but it's actually a calling. Like our soul is calling us to wake up, and there's more to life than just surviving.
Yeah, and that's where we start to get serious about. What is my career? What am I really here to do? And we stop kind of just finding those temporary jobs, you know, or jumping from one career to another and start to think seriously about what is my lifelong career and those kind of things. That happens from, you know, 30 to 40 in those early or those mid years. What happens there is if we take the opportunity to examine our emotional patterns and really do some inner work. Now, this is a big if, right? If the opportunities and then if we take the opportunities to do that inner work, then we can change those early patterns.
But if we don't, we end up just living out a destiny that was conditioned in us by everyone else but us. we kind of agreed to it, but we almost like we were very externally focused in this is what the world wants me to be. And the second part of life is who do I want to be for the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a turning point and it's such a crucial question for us. And unfortunately, societies, the way they're structured now, do not provide individuals with those opportunities, right, to really do that internal reflection, that introspection to ask those questions. So there should be, like, at that time, an institution or some kind of school that people can go to.
And like Creative Mind?
Like Creative Mind and experience that inner world and examine that. Am I really these patterns? Because what the patterns that were laid out early on from childhood and early adulthood are going to determine the rest of your life. And think about the power of that. If you do not examine them, you're simply going to repeat the pattern. And you're going to be,
call
if you're
fate.
Unhappy, I mean, if you're happy, I guess that's great. You know, you're just going to be continue to be happy. But who is really satisfied in every possible way?
Like truly happy. Like we can be satisfied and complacent. You know, I have a good family, I have a good job. But it's that feeling, it's like it doesn't have to be a big urgent thing, like some crash happens in your life. But it's that kind of feeling like you're on Groundhog Day. You're just going through the motions. You're kind of maybe get some excitement, a new crime series that you're excited about, and that's what you talk about. That's all you have. Maybe you get lost in a book, but you're really not feeling connected to people. Maybe you're losing connection with your kids or your parents, and the relationships and friends aren't as meaningful. It's more like behavior, like socially, like let's get together, but you're not really feeling like people really know you. And that's that point where you're like, do I know me? Do I know who I am? And it's a beautiful place to be when we realize that. And we realize that this ordinary life is not going to cut it. And we want to step into an extraordinary life. And an extraordinary life may look like the same out on to everyone else. But that extraordinary life is that this richness within your heart and soul and your sense of who you are and the sense of groundedness and the sense of wonder you have with the world. No one can see that on the surface. So but it's just that beautiful place. Like in Buddhism, they say the enlightened man chops wood and carries water just exactly as the unenlightened man. So it's not about acquiring things to show that you became enlightened, but more that you know yourself and you feel this deep satisfaction And when you're getting older, especially you turn like 40 and 50, you're not having all the regrets looking back and wish your life could have been differently. And you're spending time like moving forward, like how can I live the rest of my life in the most greatest capacity? And so it's a very big shift, but not many people think like that. I wish everyone would think like that, but a lot of people just kind of get more depressed and more, you know, missing, feeling like their life is slipping away versus what's ahead of me.
Absolutely. And so how do we do this, right? If these emotions are unconscious in us and kind of they're forming the assumptions about who we are and what's possible for us in the world, that work, that inner work then becomes so much more important. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways to start to kind of chip away at the barrier that between our conscious mind and our unconscious mind is to simply ask questions, right? Mm. To begin to really ask those deeper questions. Is this who I really am? Mm. Are these patterns defining me? And am I really making choices, or am I being played by my past conditioning?
Well, I always think about the emotions, like when we think about it, how we were conditioned is really this, we're moving away from pain to pleasure. So the things that we feel are painful or uncomfortable, mm-hmm. like emotions even that are uncomfortable, we want to get rid of them, you know, or numb them away. And we think they're bad and they actually are driving behavior. So when we're triggered, instead of like running away from the emotion or finding a distraction, I'm going to go for a run and burn out all this anxiety, is to actually be present with the feeling that you're having and asking the feeling like what it's about versus running from it and like labeling it as wrong and running from it, because that's what you've been doing unconsciously your whole life, is running from the fear and running from the worry, running from unhappiness and grief and all these things. And I think one of the learnings that, about emotions is that we want to feel all of them. We don't want a numb life. And when we talk about an extraordinary life, you want to feel everything and not be afraid of feeling. Like I always say, like it's just a sensation in the body eventually. Like if you think about emotions and you're the tactile feeling is all there is, and we're afraid of that tactile feeling, yeah, because we add all the story around it.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions, like we began the podcast with this idea that there's so many misconceptions in the culture about what emotions are and what they do to us. Mm. And there's this idea of good and bad.
Toxic emotions.
Yeah, that there's somehow these emotions are going to damage us or hurt us or cause us to lose our mind or something like that. For most of us, of course, those are, in extreme cases, those are all possibilities. But for most people, our emotions are like our senses. They're simply telling us about what is the meaning of our experiences.
I love that the emotions are like the senses. Yeah. They're very closely tied. Because
very closely tied. They give us the valence of what that emotion is, meaning the meaning. Mm-hmm. Is this pleasurable? Is this good for me? Or should I reconsider and back away and not engage?
Mm. Like anger can be a very powerful emotion. It's that unexpressed passion that we have to stand up for ourselves. If we didn't have anger, we would just be a doormat. And many, many people have anger in their unconscious because people, society tells you, you can't be angry. Don't be angry. And then other people, being kind and compassionate or soft can be, you know, not safe. So I'm going to be angry and push people away as a defense mechanism. So anything, any emotion can be a defense mechanism or used for that.
Yeah.
But we want to be able to feel all the emotions, mm-hmm. and be free of the conditioning of it.
Yeah, because anger, for example, and this is just one example, but it can signal that there's been a boundary violation.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, somebody has stepped over the boundaries of our personal boundaries or our mm-hmm. social boundaries, something like that. So is that really harmful to feel anger? Well, it depends on how we react. Mm. And here's the problem, that if we only think of anger as bad and that I should not express that, that I should be a logical person and reason these things out, then I'm going to repress my anger. Mm-hmm. And even if it works out that I'm able to repress it and work things out rationally, that's the difficulty with the emotion, because constant repression of emotion then builds up. It's it's a cumulative effect.
The bubble, boiling pot with the lid on it, it finally pops.
Yes. So it's not the anger that is hurting me. It's not the anger that is causing some difficulty in me. It's the repression of the anger. Mm. That's very different. It's like the anger is a healthy response to a boundary violation. Mm. It's the repression, meaning the conditioning around what I should do with the anger that might have a harmful effect on me by me repressing it and not expressing that anger over a long period of time. We know repression of anger is connected to disease, physical malfunction, in other words.
And isn't it tied to anxiety too? There's like, if you have anxiety a lot, it's like almost like the anger, you're not able to express yourself or you feel stuck. And anger, the energy of anger, we give it a label, but it's really just some part of us wants to be expressed, you know, it wants to, you know, it wants something, you know, it's like a force, you know, and then we say, ooh, it comes out as this loud thing that people think is unpleasant. So we don't want to have that. And so our behaviors and the way it's expressed in a human being is sometimes not really what the core of that emotion is. The core is just energy that, you know, our psyche wants to use. And then when we're able to express it, we could feel really passionate about things. I mean, sometimes people just sit and then they allow themselves to be angry. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, I have all this like emotion and creativity that came out. And not like you should always be angry, but you can't allow yourself to be when you are, and it's okay.
Well, again, I think the key is expression again, that you can express it verbally and you can express it passionately. You don't have to resort to violence or aggression, but still express that boundary violation, right? And call it out
and be able firm. To, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the expression right there. And learning that balance requires us to talk about it and to practice it. And so it's not an automatic thing that you shouldn't be angry. You should be logical and reasonable. Yeah, that's a good lesson. But how do you do that?
Mm-hmm. And then some people say they're frustrated, and frustration, I always say, is anger light. It's like you don't want to say you're angry. I'm frustrated, and that kind of tamping down the power of that emotion or that force that's trying to express itself, and we try to make it PC. And we end up like giving it a label that is like makes it kind of feel more suppressed.
Yeah. And then there are even higher ways of dealing with these powerful emotions that not only allow us to express them, but they actually allow us to learn from them. Mm. And this is one of the things that we teach, is that if we're able to observe our emotions, there's a witness in our mind that we can practice with. We're able to witness our emotions without being caught up in the emotion. Mm-hmm. Then we can learn the lesson that the emotion brings us. It's teaching us about the nature of our relationships, our work, and our reality.
Carl Jung, I love his quote. He says, "Something has come alive in me that needs my attention." And so that's what when we're triggered, that's what the emotion is. It's something coming alive in you that's asking for attention. It's like a knock at the door, and then you hear that, like it comes in a whisper first, and then it's like a bulldozer. And so then the transformation of this emotion, you don't need to make it positive, but it actually changes, the energy changes kind of your mind. When you drop the judgment and you examine what it is, the energy shifts in a way. It feels different because it doesn't, the label actually gives it the sense in a way.
Yeah.
You know, the top down, like there's this powerful force that's just a force. And then we give it all these labels and then it only can be fixed just like other people. And that's a mean person. That's this person. So when we label things, we end up collapsing it into a very limited expression. And then we feel like we need to make it better or positive, that dualistic approach. But imagine it just being open to this energy and just being like, oh, here it is, not needing to fix it. And there's a space that opens up that it's like creative, like our psyche is so creative. It's like, here's how you can use that energy.
Yeah, the same thing with shame, guilt, embarrassment,
grief,
on and on. All these powerful emotions are telling us about the meaning of our life. And if we repress them and we don't learn from them, we're impoverishing our mind, essentially, because we're only living at the cognitive level and trying to figure things out rationally and missing out on that deep passion that is our life. And that's where art comes from. That's where love comes from.
Writing.
The deeper sense of the meaning of our life. So it's more than emotional intelligence. It's an emotional deepening. An acknowledgement of our deeper nature, right? Of
and our emotional power, we call it the emotional power integration. One of the tools we teach in our training, it's EPI, and it really is that kind of getting the power of that emotion, not pushing it away and suppressing it. It's like suppression of power when you deny emotion. Yeah.
And going back to those early patterns, what it does, it changes, it liberates us from them, not by pushing them away or denying them, all that stored up energy of conditioning of our past experiences, now we're able to use them in a creative way so that it helps us live our life in a more creative way.
Well, we're going to feeling the emotion, drop the judgment, become curious about it. What can you learn from it through the witness mind? And then that will start shifting the pattern. And what I notice when I sit with emotion, I see all my patterns kind of like, it's like your life passing before your eyes, like how this emotion or me avoiding this emotion has limited my life and my expression and how I please or how I didn't keep a boundary here. And then all of a sudden it frees up and you're getting that unconscious, you're making it conscious. And then now you can be in control of if you want to be angry, if you're not, it doesn't come explosively or in the form of a health issue because you've suppressed it so much. I mean, so much of our health and anxiety is because we don't know how to work with our emotions.
Yeah. And a lot of people we work with, they tell us that especially around work and success, that working with their emotion liberates them from those conditioned assumptions about wealth and success that if you never do this work, they remain from those early experiences. You know, our parents often told us that rich people were bad or that successful people were evil or up to no good or something like that. All those subtle impressions remain in our psyche until we're able to release them and to transform them. Then we can decide who we want to be and how successful we want to be in our lives.
Yeah. So thank you for joining us again on Soul Sessions. Please don't forget to subscribe to our channel. If you're watching us on YouTube, this little button here in the corner, click it and subscribe to our channel. And if you're listening to us on Spotify, iTunes, or any of those great podcast services, please do us a favor and subscribe because that helps us a lot getting more subscribers and getting our messages out to more people. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Feel all the feelers. Enjoy your emotions. And we'll see you next time.
See you soon.
Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe to Creative Mind Soul Sessions. And join us next week as we explore another deep topic where you can consciously create your life with Creative Mind Soul Sessions. See you next time.